It was just about a week before Valeska committed suicide that I ran into Mara. The week or two preceding that event was a veritable nightmare, a series of sudden deaths and strange encounters with women. First of all, there was Pauline Janowski, a little Jewess of 16 or 17 who was without a home and without friends or relatives. She came to the office looking for a job. It was toward closing time, and I didn't have the heart to turn her down cold. For some reason or other, I took it into my head to bring her home for dinner, and if possible try to persuade the wife to put her up for a while. What attracted me to her was her passion for Balzac. All the way home she was talking to me about lost illusions. The car was packed, and we were jammed so tight together that it didn't make any difference what we were talking about because we were both thinking of only one thing. My wife, of course, was stupefied to see me standing at the door with a beautiful young girl. She was polite and courteous in her frigid way, but I could see immediately that it was no use asking her to put the girl up. It was about all she could do to sit through the dinner with us. As soon as we had finished, she excused herself and went to the movies. The girl started to weep. We were still sitting at the table, the dishes piled up in front of us. I went over to her and I put my arms around her. I felt genuinely sorry for her, and I was perplexed as to what to do for her. Suddenly she threw her arms around my neck, and she kissed me passionately. We stood there a long while, embracing each other, and then I thought to myself, no, it's a crime, and besides, maybe the wife didn't go to the movies at all, maybe she'll be ducking back any minute. I told the kid to pull herself together, that we'd take a trolley ride somewhere. I saw the child's bank lying on the mantelpiece, and I took it to the toilet and emptied it silently. There was only about 75 cents in it. We got on a trolley and went to the beach. Finally, we found a deserted spot, and we lay down in the sand. She was hysterically passionate, and there was nothing to do but to do it. I thought she would reproach me afterwards, but she didn't. We lay there a while, and she began to talk about Balzac again. It seemed she had ambitions to be a writer herself. I asked her what she was going to do. She said she hadn't the least idea. When we got up to go, she asked me to put her on the highway. Said she thought she would go to Cleveland or someplace. It was after midnight when I left her standing in front of a gas station. She had about 35 cents in her pocketbook. As I started homeward, I began cursing my wife for the mean bitch that she was. I wished to Christ it was she whom I had left standing on the highway with no place to go to. I knew that when I got back, she wouldn't even mention the girl's name. I got back, and she was waiting up for me. I thought she was going to give me hell again, but no, she had waited up because there was an important message from O'Rourke. I was to telephone him soon as I got home. However, I decided not to telephone. I decided to get undressed and go to bed. Just when I had gotten comfortably settled, the telephone rang. It was O'Rourke. There was a telegram for me at the office. He wanted to know if he should open it and read it to me. I said, of course. The telegram was signed Monica. It was from Buffalo. Said she was arriving at the Grand Central in the morning with her mother's body. I thanked him and went back to bed. No questions from the wife. I lay there wondering what to do. If I were to comply with the request, that would mean starting things all over again. I had just been thanking my stars that I had gotten rid of Monica, and now she was coming back with her mother's corpse. Tears and reconciliation. No, I didn't like the prospect at all. Supposing I didn't show up, what then? There was always somebody around to take care of a corpse. Especially if the bereaved were an attractive young blonde with sparkling blue eyes. I wondered if she'd go back to her job in the restaurant. If she hadn't known Greek and Latin, I would never have been mixed up with her. But my curiosity got the better of me. And then she was so goddamned poor, that too got me. Maybe it wouldn't have been so bad if her hands hadn't smelled greasy. That was the fly in the ointment. The greasy hands. I remember the first night I met her, and we strolled through the park. She was ravishing to look at, and she was alert and intelligent. It was just the time when women were wearing short skirts, and she wore them to advantage. I used to go to the restaurant night after night, just to watch her moving around, watch her bending over to serve or stooping down to pick up a fork. And with the beautiful legs and the bewitching eyes, a marvelous line about Homer. With the pork and sauerkraut, a verse of Sappho's, the Latin conjugations, the odes of Pindar, with the dessert, perhaps the Rubaiyat, or Sinara. But the greasy hands and the frowsy bed in the boarding house opposite the marketplace? Phew, I couldn't stomach it. The more I shunned her, the more clinging she became. 10-page letters about love, with footnotes on Thus Spake Zarathustra. And then suddenly silence, and me congratulating myself heartily. No, I couldn't bring myself to go to the Grand Central Station in the morning. I rolled over, and I fell sound asleep. In the morning I would get the wife to telephone the office and say I was ill. I hadn't been ill now for over a week. It was coming to me. At noon I find Kronsky waiting for me outside the office. He wants me to have lunch with him. There's an Egyptian girl he wants me to meet. The girl turns out to be a Jewess, but she came from Egypt, and she looks like an Egyptian. She's hot stuff, and the two of us are working on her at once. As I was supposed to be ill, I decided not to return to the office, but to take a stroll through the east side. Kronsky was going back to cover me up. We shook hands with the girl, and we each went our separate ways. I headed toward the river, where it was cool, having forgotten about the girl almost immediately. I sat on the edge of the pier with my legs dangling over the string piece. A scow passed with a load of red bricks. Suddenly Monica came to my mind. Monica arriving at the Grand Central Station with a corpse. A corpse FOB New York. It seemed so incongruous and ridiculous that I burst out laughing. What had she done with it? Had she checked it, or had she left it on a siding? No doubt she was cursing me out roundly. I wondered what she would really think if she could have imagined me sitting there at the dock with my legs dangling over the string piece. It was warm and sultry, despite the breeze that was blowing off the river. I began to snooze. As I dozed off, Pauline came to my mind. I imagined her walking along the highway with her hand up. She was a brave kid, no doubt about it. Funny that she didn't seem to worry about getting knocked up. Maybe she was so desperate she didn't care. And Balzac. That, too, was highly incongruous. Why Balzac? Well, that was her affair. Anyway, she'd have enough to eat with until she met another guy. But a kid like that, thinking about becoming a writer. Well, why not? Everybody had illusions of one sort or another. Monica, too, wanted to be a writer. Everybody was becoming a writer. A writer. Jesus, how futile it seemed. I dozed off. When I woke up, I had an erection. The sun seemed to be burning right into my fly. I got up and I washed my face at the drinking fountain. It was still as hot and sultry as ever. The asphalt was soft as mush, the flies were biting, the garbage was rotting in the gutter. I walked about between the pushcarts and looked at things with an empty eye. I had a sort of lingering hard-on all the while, but no definite object in mind. It was only when I got back to Second Avenue that I suddenly remembered the Egyptian Jewess from lunchtime. I remembered her saying that she lived over the Russian restaurant near 12th Street. Still, I hadn't any definite idea of what I was going to do. Just browsing about, killing time. My feet, nevertheless, were dragging me northward, toward 14th Street. When I got abreast of the Russian restaurant, I paused a moment, and then I ran up the stairs three at a time. The hall door was open. I climbed up a couple of flights, scanning the names on the doors. She was on the top floor, and there was a man's name under hers. I knocked softly. No answer. I knocked again, a little harder. This time I heard someone moving about. Then a voice close to the door, asking who is it, and at the same time the knob turning. I pushed the door open and stumbled into the darkened room, stumbled right into her arms and felt her naked under the half-opened kimono. She must have come out of a sound sleep and only half realized who was holding her in his arms. When she realized it was me, she tried to break away, but I had her tight, and I began kissing her passionately and at the same time backing her up toward the couch near the window. She mumbled something about the door being open, but I wasn't taking any chance on letting her slip out of my arms. So I made a slight detour, and little by little I edged her toward the door and made her shove it to with her ass. I locked it with my one free hand, and then I moved her into the center of the room, and with the free hand I unbuttoned my fly and got my pecker out and into position. She was so drugged with sleep that it was almost like working on an automaton. I could see, too, that she was enjoying the idea of being fucked half asleep. The only thing was that every time I made a lunge, she grew more wide awake, and as she grew more conscious, she became more frightened. It was difficult to know how to put her to sleep again without losing a good fuck. I managed to tumble her onto the couch without losing ground, and she was hot as hell now, twisting and squirming like an eel. From the time I had started to maul her, I don't think she had opened her eyes once. I kept saying to myself, "An Egyptian fuck. An Egyptian fuck." And so as not to shoot off immediately, I deliberately began thinking about the corpse that Monica had dragged to the Grand Central Station and about the 35 cents that I had left with Pauline on the highway. Then bango. A loud knock on the door, and with that she opens her eyes wide and looks at me in utmost terror. I started to pull away quickly, but to my surprise she held me tight. "Don't move," she whispered in my ear. "Wait." There was another loud knock, and then I heard Kronsky's voice saying, "It's me, Thelma. It's me, Izzy." At that I almost burst out laughing. We slumped back again into a natural position, and as her eyes softly closed, I moved it around inside her, gently, so as not to wake her up again. It was one of the most wonderful fucks I ever had in my life. I thought it was going to last forever. Whenever I felt in danger of going off, I would stop moving and think. Think, for example, of where I would like to spend my vacation, if I got one, or think of the shirts lying in the bureau drawer, or the patch in the bedroom carpet just at the foot of the bed. Kronsky was still standing at the door. I could hear him changing about from one position to another. Every time I became aware of him standing there, I jibbed her a little for good measure, and in her half-sleep she answered back, humorously, as though she understood what I meant by this put-and-take language. I didn't dare to think what she might be thinking, or I'd have come immediately. Sometimes I skirted dangerously close to it, but the saving trick was always Monica and the corpse at the Grand Central Station. The thought of that, the humorousness of it, I mean, acted like a cold douche. When it was all over, she opened her eyes wide and stared at me, as though she were taking me in for the first time. I hadn't a word to say to her. The only thought in my head was to get out as quickly as possible. As we were washing up, I noticed a note on the floor near the door. It was from Kronsky. His wife had just been taken to the hospital. He wanted her to meet him at the hospital. I felt relieved. It meant that I could break away without wasting any words. The next day I had a telephone call from Kronsky. His wife had died on the operating table. That evening I went home for dinner. We were still at the table when the bell rang. There was Kronsky, standing at the gate, looking absolutely sunk. It was always difficult for me to offer words of condolence. With him it was absolutely impossible. I listened to my wife uttering her trite words of sympathy, and I felt more than ever disgusted with her. "Let's get out of here," I said. We walked along in absolute silence for a while. At the park we turned in and headed for the meadows. There was a heavy mist which made it impossible to see a yard ahead. Suddenly, as we were swimming along, he began to sob. I stopped and turned my head away. When I thought he had finished, I looked around, and there he was staring at me, with a strange smile. "It's funny," he said, "how hard it is to accept death." I smiled too now, and put my hand on his shoulder. "Go on," I said. "Talk your head off. Get it off your chest." We started walking again, up and down over the meadows, as though we were walking under the sea. The mist had become so thick that I could just barely discern his features. He was talking quietly and madly. "I knew it would happen," he said. "It was too beautiful to last." The night before she was taken ill, he had had a dream. He dreamt that he had lost his identity. "I was stumbling around in the dark, calling my own name. I remember coming to a bridge, and looking down into the water, I saw myself drowning. I jumped off the bridge, head first, and when I came up, I saw Yetta, floating under the bridge. She was dead." And then suddenly he added, "You were there yesterday when I knocked at the door, weren't you? I knew you were there, and I couldn't go away. I knew, too, that Yetta was dying, and I wanted to be with her, but I was afraid to go alone." I said nothing, and he rambled on. "The first girl I ever loved died in the same way. I was only a kid, and I couldn't get over it. Every night I used to go to the cemetery and sit by her grave. People thought I was out of my mind. I guess I was out of my mind. Yesterday, when I was standing at the door, it all came back to me. I was back in Trenton, at the grave, and the sister of the girl I loved was sitting beside me. She said it couldn't go on that way much longer, that I would go mad. I thought to myself that I really was mad, and to prove it to myself, I decided to do something mad, and so I said to her, 'It isn't her I love, it's you,' and I pulled her over me, and we lay there kissing each other, and finally I screwed her, right beside the grave. and I think that cured me because I never went back there again, and I never thought about her anymore, until yesterday when I was standing at the door. If I could have gotten hold of you yesterday, I would have strangled you. I don't know why I felt that way, but it seemed to me that you had opened up a tomb, that you were violating the dead body of the girl I loved. That's crazy, isn't it? And why did I come see you tonight? Maybe it's because you're absolutely indifferent to me. Because you're not a Jew and I can talk to you. Because you don't give a damn, and you're right. Did you ever read The Revolt of the Angels? We had just arrived at the bicycle path which encircles the park. The lights of the boulevard were swimming in the mist. I took a good look at him and saw that he was out of his head. I wondered if I could make him laugh. I was afraid, too, that if he once got started laughing, he would never stop. So I began to talk at random, about Anatole France at first, and then about other writers. And finally, when I felt that I was losing him, I suddenly switched to General Ivolgin, and with that he began to laugh, not a laugh either, but a cackle, a hideous cackle, like a rooster with its head on the block. It got him so badly that he had to stop and hold his guts. The tears were streaming down his eyes, and between the cackles he let out the most terrible, heart-rending sobs. "I knew you would do me good," he blurted out, as the last outbreak died away. "I always said you were a crazy son of a bitch. You're a Jew bastard yourself, only you don't know it. Now tell me, you bastard, how was it yesterday? Did you get your end in? Didn't I tell you she was a good lay? And do you know who she's living with? Jesus, you were lucky you didn't get caught. She's living with a Russian poet. You know the guy, too. I introduced you to him once at the Café Royal. Better not let him get wind of it. He'll beat your brains out, and then he'll write a beautiful poem about it and send it to her with a bunch of roses. Sure, I knew him out in Stelton, in the anarchist colony. His old man was a nihilist. The whole family's crazy. By the way, you'd better take care of yourself. I meant to tell you that the other day, but I didn't think you would act so quickly. You know she may have syphilis. I'm not trying to scare you. I'm just telling you for your own good." This outburst seemed to really assuage him. He was trying to tell me, in his twisted Jewish way, that he liked me. To do so, he had to first destroy everything around me, the wife, the job, my friends, the nigger wench, as he called Valeska, and so on. "I think someday you're going to be a great writer," he said. "But," he added maliciously, "first you'll have to suffer a bit. I mean really suffer, because you don't know what the word means yet. You only think you've suffered. You've got to fall in love first. That nigger wench, now. You don't really suppose that you're in love with her, do you? Did you ever take a good look at her ass? How it's spreading, I mean? In 5 years she'll look like Aunt Jemima. You'll make a swell couple walking down the avenue with a string of pickaninnies trailing behind you. Jesus, I'd rather see you marry a Jewish girl. You wouldn't appreciate her, of course, but she'd be good for you. You need something to steady yourself. You're scattering your energies. Listen, why do you run around with all these dumb bastards you pick up? You seem to have a genius for picking up the wrong people. Why don't you throw yourself into something useful? You don't belong in that job. You could be a big guy somewhere. Maybe a labor leader. I don't know what exactly. But first, you've got to get rid of that hatchet-faced wife of yours. Ugh! When I look at her, I could spit in her face. I don't see how a guy like you could ever have married a bitch like that. What was it, just a pair of steaming ovaries? Listen, that's what's the matter with you. You've got nothing but sex on the brain. No, I don't mean that either. You've got a mind, and you've got passion and enthusiasm, but you don't seem to give a damn what you do or what happens to you. If you weren't such a romantic bastard, I'd almost swear that you were a Jew. It's different with me. I never had anything to look forward to. But you've got something in you, only you're too damn lazy to bring it out. Listen, when I hear you talk sometimes, I think to myself, if only that guy would put it down on paper. Why, you could write a book that would make a guy like Dreiser hang his head. You're different from the Americans I know. Somehow you don't belong, and it's a damn good thing you don't. You're a little cracked, too. I suppose you know that, but in a good way. Listen, a little while ago, if it had been anybody else who talked to me that way, I'd have murdered him. I think I like you better because you didn't try to give me any sympathy. I know better than to expect sympathy from you. If you had said one false word tonight, I'd have really gone mad. I know it. I was on the very edge. When you started in about General Ivolgin, I thought for a minute it was all up with me. That's what makes me think you've got something in you. That was real cunning, And now let me tell you something. If you don't pull yourself together soon, you're going to be screwy. You've got something inside you that's eating you up. I don't know what it is, but you can't put it over on me. I know you from the bottom up. I know there's something griping you, and it's not just your wife, nor your job, nor even that nigger wench whom you think you're in love with. Sometimes I think you were born in the wrong time. Listen, I don't want you to think I'm making an idol of you, but there's something to what I say. If you had just a little more confidence in yourself, you could be the biggest man in the world today. You wouldn't even have to be a writer. You might become another Jesus Christ, for all I know. Don't laugh, I mean it. You haven't the slightest idea of your own possibilities. You're absolutely blind to everything except your own desires. You don't know what you want. You don't know because you never stop to think. You're letting people use you up. You're a damned fool, an idiot. If I had a tenth of what you've got, I could turn the world upside down. You think that's crazy, eh? Well, listen to me. I was never more sane in my life. When I came to see you tonight, I thought I was about ready to commit suicide. It doesn't make much difference whether I do it or not, but anyway, I don't see much point in doing it now. That won't bring her back to me. I was born unlucky. Wherever I go, I seem to bring disaster, but I don't want to kick off yet. I want to do some good in the world first. That may sound silly to you, but it's true. I'd like to do something for others. He stopped abruptly and looked at me again with that strange, wan smile. It was the look of a hopeless Jew, in whom, as with all his race, the life instinct was so strong that even though there was absolutely nothing to hope for, he was powerless to kill himself. That hopelessness was something quite alien to me. I thought to myself, if only we could change skins. Why, I could kill myself for a bagatelle. And what got me more than anything was the thought that he wouldn't even enjoy the funeral, his own wife's funeral. God knows the funerals we had were sorry enough affairs, but there was always a bit of food and drink afterwards, and some good obscene jokes and some hearty belly laughs. Maybe I was too young to appreciate the sorrowful aspects, though I saw plainly enough how they howled and wept. But that never meant much to me, because after the funeral, sitting in the beer garden next to the cemetery, there was always an atmosphere of good cheer, despite the black garments and the crepes and the wreaths. It seemed to me, as a kid then, that they were really trying to establish some sort of communion with the dead person. Something almost Egyptian-like, when I think back on it. Once upon a time, I thought they were just a bunch of hypocrites, but they weren't. They were just stupid, healthy Germans with a lust for life. Death was something outside their ken, strange to say, because if you went only by what they said, you would imagine that it occupied a good deal of their thoughts. But they really didn't grasp it at all. Not the way the Jew does, for example. They talked about the life hereafter, but they never really believed in it. And if anyone were so bereaved as to pine away, they looked upon that person suspiciously, as you would look upon an insane person. There were limits to sorrow, as there were limits to joy. That was the impression they gave me. And at the extreme limits, there was always the stomach which had to be filled, with Limburger sandwiches, and beer, and kimmel, and turkey legs, if there were any about. They wept in their beer, like children. And the next minute they were laughing over some curious quirk in the dead person's character. Even the way they used the past tense had a curious effect upon me. An hour after he was shoveled under, they were saying of the defunct, "He was always so good-natured." As though the person in mind were dead 1,000 years, a character in history, or a personage out of the Nibelungenlied. The thing was that he was dead, definitely dead, for all time. And they, the living, were cut off from him now, and forever, and today as well as tomorrow must be lived through, the clothes washed, the dinner prepared, and when the next one was struck down there would be a coffin to select and a squabble about the will, but it would be all in the daily routine, and to take time off to grieve and sorrow was sinful, because God, if there was a God, had ordained it that way, and we on earth had nothing to say about it. To go beyond the ordained limits of joy or grief was wicked. To threaten madness was the high sin. They had a terrific animal sense of adjustment, marvelous to behold if it had been truly animal, horrible to witness when you realize that it was nothing more than dull German torpor, insensitivity. And yet somehow, I preferred these animated stomachs to the hydra-headed sorrow of the Jew. At bottom, I couldn't feel sorry for Kronsky. I would have to feel sorry for his whole tribe. The death of his wife was only an item, a trifle in the history of his calamities. As he himself had said, he was born unlucky. He was born to see things go wrong, because for 5,000 years things had been going wrong in the blood of the race. They came into the world with that sunken, hopeless leer on their faces, and they would go out of the world the same way. They left a bad smell behind them, a poison, a vomit of sorrow. The stink they were hying to take out of the world was the stink they themselves had brought into the world. I reflected on all this as I listened to him. I felt so well and clean inside that when we parted, after I had turned down a side street, I began to whistle and hum. And then a terrible thirst came upon me, and I says to meself in me best Irish brogue, "Sure, and it's a bit of a drink ye should be having now, me lad," and saying it, I stumbled into a hole in the wall, and I ordered a big foaming stein of beer and a thick hamburger sandwich with plenty of onions. I had another mug of beer and then a drop of brandy, and I thought to myself in my callous way, "If the poor bastard hasn't got brains enough to enjoy his own wife's funeral, then I'll enjoy it for him." And the more I thought about it, the happier I grew. And if there was the least bit of grief or envy, it was only for the fact that I couldn't change places with her, the poor dead Jewish soul, because death was something absolutely beyond the grip and comprehension of a dumb goy like myself, and it was a pity to waste it on the likes of them as knew all about it and didn't need it anyway. I got so damned intoxicated with the idea of dying that in my drunken stupor I was mumbling to the God above to kill me this night, kill me, God, and let me know what it's all about. I tried my stinking best to imagine what it was like, giving up the ghost, but it was no go. The best I could do was to imitate a death rattle, but on that I nearly choked, and then I got so damned frightened that I almost shit in my pants. That wasn't death anyway. That was just choking. Death was more like what we went through in the park. Two people walking side by side in the mist, rubbing against trees and bushes, and not a word between them. It was something emptier than the name itself, and yet right and peaceful, dignified, if you like. It was not a continuation of life, but a leap in the dark, and no possibility of ever coming back, not even as a grain of dust. And that was right and beautiful, I said to myself, because why would one want to come back? To taste it once is to taste it forever, life or death. Whichever way the coin flips is right, so long as you hold no stakes. Sure, it's tough to choke on your own spittle. It's disagreeable, more than anything else. And besides, one doesn't always die choking to death. Sometimes one goes off in his sleep, peaceful and quiet as a lamb. The Lord comes and gathers you up into the fold, as they say. Anyway, you stop breathing. And why the hell should one want to go on breathing forever? Anything that would have to be done interminably would be torture. The poor human bastards that we are, we ought to be glad that somebody devised a way out. We don't quibble about going to sleep. A third of our lives we snore away like drunken rats. What about that? Is that tragic? Well then, say three-thirds of drunken rat-like sleep. Jesus, if we had any sense, we'd be dancing with glee at the thought of it. We could all die in bed tomorrow, without pain, without suffering, if we had the sense to take advantage of our remedies. We don't want to die. That's the trouble with us. That's why God and the whole shooting match upstairs in our crazy dustbins. Generally Volgin, that got a cackle out of him and a few dry sobs. I might as well have said Limburger cheese. But generally Volgin means something to him, something crazy. Limburger cheese would be too sober, too banal. It's all Limburger cheese, however, including General Ivolgin, the poor drunken sap. General Ivolgin was evolved out of Dostoevsky's Limburger cheese, his own private brand. That means a certain flavor, a certain label, so people recognize it when they smell it, taste it. But what made this General Ivolgin Limburger cheese? Why, whatever made Limburger cheese, which is X and therefore unknowable, and so, therefore nothing, nothing at all. Full stop, or else a leap in the dark, and no coming back. As I was taking my pants off, I suddenly remembered what the bastard had told me. I looked at my cock, and it looked just as innocent as ever. "Don't tell me you've got the sif," I said, holding it in my hand and squeezing it a bit, as though I might see a bit of pus squirting out. No, I didn't think there was much chance of having the sif. I wasn't born under that kind of star. The clap, yes, that was possible. Everybody had the clap sometime or other. But not sif. I knew he'd wish it on me if he could, just to make me realize what suffering was. But I couldn't be bothered obliging him. I was born a dumb but lucky goy. I yawned. It was all so much goddamned Limburger cheese that Sif or no Sif, I thought to myself, if she's up to it, I'll tear off another piece and call it a day. But evidently she wasn't up to it. She was for turning her ass on me. So I just lay there with a stiff prick up against her ass, and I gave it to her by mental telepathy. And by Jesus, she must have gotten the message sound asleep though she was, because it wasn't any trouble going in by the stable door. And besides, I didn't have to look at her face, which was one hell of a relief. I thought to myself, as I gave her the last hook and whistle, "Me lad, it's Limburger cheese, and now you can turn over and snore." It seemed as if it would go on forever, the sex and death chant. The very next afternoon at the office, I received a telephone call from my wife, saying that her friend Arlene had just been taken to the insane asylum. They were friends from the convent school in Canada, where they had both studied music and the art of masturbation. I had met the whole flock of them little by little, including Sister Antolina, who wore a truss and who apparently was the high priestess of the cult of Onanism. They had all had a crush on Sister Antolina at one time or another. And Arlene, with the chocolate eclair mug, wasn't the first of the little group to go to the insane asylum. I don't say it was masturbation that drove them there, but certainly the atmosphere of the convent had something to do with it. They were all spoiled in the egg. Before the afternoon was over, my old friend McGregor walked in. He arrived looking glum as usual and complaining about the advent of old age, though he was hardly past 30. When I told him about Arlene, he seemed to liven up a bit. He said he always knew there was something wrong with her. Why? Because when he tried to force her one night, she began to weep hysterically. It wasn't the weeping as much as what she said. She said she had sinned against the Holy Ghost, and for that she would have to lead a life of continence. Recalling the incident, he began to laugh in his mirthless way. I said to her, "Well, you don't need to do it if you don't want. Just hold it in your hand." Jesus, when I said that, I thought she'd go clean off her nut. She said I was trying to soil her innocence. That's the way she put it. And at the same time, she took it in her hand, and she squeezed it so hard it damn near fainted. Weeping all the while, too. And still harping on the Holy Ghost and her innocence. I remembered what you told me once, and so I gave her a sound slap in the jaw. It worked like magic. She quieted down after a bit, enough to let me slip it in. And then the real fun commenced. Listen, did you ever fuck a crazy woman? It's something to experience. From the instant I got it in, she started talking a blue streak. I can't describe it to you exactly, but it was almost as though she didn't know I was fucking her. Listen, I don't know whether you've ever had a woman eat an apple while you were doing it. Well, you can imagine how that affects you. This one was 1,000 times worse. It got on my nerves so that I began to think I was a little queer myself. And now here's something you'll hardly believe, but I'm telling you the truth. You know what she did when we got through? She put her arms around me, and she thanked me. Wait, that isn't all. Then she got out of bed, and she knelt down and offered up a prayer for my soul. Jesus, I remember that so well. "Please make Mac a better Christian," she said, and me lying there with a limp cock listening to her. I didn't know whether I was dreaming or what. "Please make Mac a better Christian. Can you beat that?" "What are you doing tonight?" he added cheerfully. "Nothing special," I said. "Then come along with me. I've got a gal I want you to meet, Paula. I picked her up at the Roseland a few nights ago. She's not crazy, she's just a nymphomaniac. I want to see you dance with her. It'll be a treat just to watch you. Listen, if you don't shoot off in your pants when she starts wiggling, well then I'm a son of a bitch. Come on, close the joint. What's the use of farting around in this place?" There was a lot of time to kill before going to the Roseland, so we went to a little hole in the wall over near 7th Avenue. Before the war, it was a French joint. Now it was a speakeasy, run by a couple of wops. There was a tiny bar near the door, and in the back a little room with a sawdust floor and a slot machine for music. The idea was that we were to have a couple of drinks and then eat. That was the idea. Knowing him as I did, however, I wasn't at all sure that we would be going to the Roseland together. If a woman should come along who pleased his fancy, and for that she didn't have to be either beautiful or sound of wind and limb, I knew he'd leave me in the lurch and beat it. The only thing that concerned me when I was with him was to make sure in advance that he had enough money to pay for the drinks we ordered, and, of course, never let him out of my sight until the drinks were paid for. The first drink or two always plunged him into reminiscence. Reminiscences of Kant, to be sure. His reminiscences were reminiscent of a story he had told me once, and which made an indelible impression upon me. It was about a Scotchman on his deathbed. Just as he was about to pass away, his wife, seeing him struggling to say something, bends over him tenderly and says, "What is it, Jock? What is it you're trying to say?" And Jock, with a last effort, raises himself wearily and says, "Just cunt, cunt, cunt." That was always the opening theme and the ending theme with MacGregor. It was his way of saying futility. The leitmotif was disease, because between fucks, as it were, he worried his head off, or rather he worried the head off his cock. It was the most natural thing in the world at the end of an evening for him to say, "Come on upstairs a minute, I want to show you my cock." From taking it out and looking at it and washing it and scrubbing it a dozen times a day, naturally his cock was always swollen and inflamed. Every now and then he went to the doctor, and he had it sounded. Or just to relieve him, the doctor would give him a little box of salve and tell him not to drink so much. This would cause no end of debate, because, as he would say to me, "If the salve is any good, why do I have to stop drinking?" Or, "If I stop drinking altogether, do you think I would need to use the salve?" Of course, whatever I recommended went in one ear and out the other. He had to worry about something, and the penis was certainly good food for worry. Sometimes he worried about his scalp. He had dandruff, as most everybody has, and when his cock was in good condition, he forgot about that, and he worried about his scalp. Or else his chest. The moment he thought about his chest, he would start to cough. And such coughing! As though he were in the last stages of consumption. And when he was running after a woman, he was as nervous and irritable as a cat. He couldn't get her quickly enough. The moment he had her, he was worrying about how to get rid of her. They all had something wrong with them, some trivial little thing, usually, which took the edge off his appetite. He was rehearsing all this as we sat in the gloom of the back room. After a couple of drinks, he got up, as usual, to go to the toilet, and on his way he dropped a coin in the slot machine, and the jiggers began to jiggle, and with that he perked up, and pointing to the glasses, he said, "Order another round." He came back from the toilet looking extraordinarily complacent, whether because he had relieved his bladder or because he had run into a girl in the hallway. I don't know. Anyhow, as he sat down, he started in on another tack, very composed now and very serene, almost like a philosopher. "You know, Henry, we're getting on in years. You and I oughtn't to be frittering our time away like this. If we're ever going to amount to anything, it's high time we started in." I had been hearing this line for years now, and I knew what the upshot would be. This was just a little parenthesis while he calmly glanced about the room and decided which bimbo was the least sottish-looking. While he discoursed about the miserable failure of our lives, his feet were dancing and his eyes were getting brighter and brighter. It would happen as it always happened, that just as he was saying, "Now you take Woodruff, for instance. He'll never get ahead because he's just a natural, mean, scrunging son of a bitch." Just at such a moment, as I say, it would happen that some drunken cow in passing the table would catch his eye, and without the slightest pause he would interrupt his narrative to say, "Hello, kid. Why don't you sit down and have a drink with us?" And as a drunken bitch like that never travels alone but always in pairs, why, she'd respond with a, "Certainly. Can I bring my friend over?" And MacGregor, as though he were the most gallant chap in the world, would say, "Why, sure, why not? What's her name?" And then, tugging at my sleeve, he'd bend over and whisper, "Don't you beat it on me, do you hear? We'll give him one drink and get rid of them, see?" And, as it always happened, one drink led to another, and the bill was getting too high, and he couldn't see why he should waste his money on a couple of bums, "so you go out first, Henry, and pretend you're buying some medicine, and I'll follow in a few minutes. But wait for me, you son of a bitch. Don't leave me in the lurch like you did the last time." And like I always did, when I got outside, I walked away as fast as my legs would carry me, laughing to myself and thanking my lucky stars that I had gotten away from him as easily as I had. With all those drinks under my belt, it didn't matter much where my feet were dragging me. Broadway lit up just as crazy as ever, and the crowd thick as molasses. Just fling yourself into it like an ant and let yourself get pushed along. Everybody doing it, some for a good reason, and some for no reason at all. All this push and movement, representing action, success, get ahead. Stop and look at shoes or fancy shirts, the new fall overcoat, wedding rings at 98 cents apiece. every other joint a food emporium. Every time I hit that runway toward dinner hour, a fever of expectancy seized me. It's only a stretch of a few blocks from Times Square to 50th Street, and when one says Broadway, that's all that's really meant, and it's really nothing, just a chicken run, and a lousy one at that, but at 7 in the evening, when everybody's rushing for a table, there's a sort of electrical crackle in the air, and your hair stands on end like antennae, and if you're receptive, you not only get every flash and flicker, but you get the statistical itch, the quid pro quo of the interactive, interstitial, ectoplasmatic quantum of bodies jostling in space like the stars which compose the Milky Way. Only this is the gay white way, the top of the world with no roof above and not even a crack or a hole under your feet to fall through and say it's a lie. The absolute impersonality of it brings you to a pitch of warm human delirium which makes you run forward like a blind nag and wag your delirious ears. Everyone is so utterly, confoundedly not himself that you become automatically the personification of the whole human race, shaking hands with 1,000 human hands, cackling with 1,000 different human tongues, cursing, applauding, whistling, crooning, soliloquizing, orating, gesticulating, urinating, fecundating, wheedling, cajoling, whimpering, bartering, pimping, caterwauling, and so on and so forth. You are all the men who ever lived up to Moses, and beyond that you are a woman buying a hat, or a birdcage, or just a mousetrap. You can lie in wait in a show window like a 14-carat gold ring, or you can climb the side of a building like a human fly, but nothing will stop the procession, not even umbrellas flying at lightning speed, nor double-decked walruses marching calmly to the oyster banks. Broadway, such as I see it now and have seen it for 25 years, is a ramp that was conceived by St. Thomas Aquinas while he was yet in the womb. It was meant originally to be used only by snakes and lizards, by the horned toad and the red heron, but when the great Spanish Armada was sunk, the human kind wriggled out of the catch and slopped over, creating by a sort of foul, ignominious squirm and wiggle the cunt-like cleft that runs from the Battery South to the golf links north through the dead and wormy center of Manhattan Island. From Times Square to 50th Street, all that St. Thomas Aquinas forgot to include in his magnum opus is here included, which is to say, among other things, hamburger sandwiches, collar buttons, poodle dogs, slot machines, gray bowlers, typewriter ribbons, orange sticks, free toilets, sanitary napkins, mint jujubes, billiard balls, chopped onions, crinkled doilies, manholes, chewing gum, sidecars and sour balls, cellophane, cord tires, magnetos, horse liniment, cough drops, phenomint, and that feline opacity of the hysterically endowed eunuch who marches to the soda fountain with a sawed-off shotgun between his legs. The before-dinner atmosphere, the blend of patchouli, warm pitch blend, iced electricity, sugared sweat, and powdered urine, drives one on to a fever of delirious expectancy. Christ will never more come down to earth, nor will there be any lawgiver, nor will murder cease, nor theft, nor rape. And yet one expects something, something terrifyingly marvelous and absurd, perhaps a cold lobster with mayonnaise served gratis, perhaps an invention, like the electric light, like television, only more devastating, more soul-rending, an invention unthinkable that will bring a shattering calm and void, not the calm and void of death, but of life such as the monks dreamed, such as is dreamed still in the Himalayas, in Tibet, in Lahore, in the Aleutian Islands, in Polynesia, in Easter Island, the dream of men before the flood, before the word was written, the dream of cavemen and anthropophagists, of those with double sex and short tails, of those who are said to be crazy and have no way of defending themselves because they are outnumbered by those who are not crazy. Cold energy trapped by cunning brutes and then set free like explosive rockets, wheels intricately interwheeled to give the illusion of force and speed, some for light, some for power, some for motion, words wired by maniacs and mounted like false teeth, perfect and repulsive as lepers, ingratiating, soft, slippery, nonsensical movement, vertical, horizontal, circular, between walls and through walls, for pleasure, for barter, for crime, for sex, all light, movement, power, impersonally conceived, generated and distributed through a choked, cunt-like cleft intended to dazzle and awe the savage, the yokel, the alien, but nobody dazzled or awed, this one hungry, that one lecherous, all one and the same and no different from the savage, the yokel, the alien, except for odds and ends, bric-a-brac, the soapsuds of thought, the sawdust of the mind. In the same cunty cleft, trapped and undazzled, millions have walked before me, among them one Blaise Cendrars, who afterwards flew to the moon, thence back to earth and up the Orinoco, impersonating a wild man but actually sound as a button, though no longer vulnerable, no longer mortal, a splendiferous hulk of a poem, dedicated to the archipelago of insomnia. Of those with fever, few hatched. Among them, myself, still unhatched, but pervious and maculate, knowing with quiet ferocity the ennui of ceaseless drift and movement. Before dinner, the slat and chink of skylight softly percolating through the bounded gray dome, the vagrant hemispheres spored with blue-egged nuclei coagulating, ramifying, in the one basket lobsters, in the other the germination of a world antiseptically personal and absolute. Out of the manholes, gray with the underground life, men of the future world saturated with shit, the iced electricity biting into them like rats, the day done in, and darkness coming on like the cool, refreshing shadows of the sewers. Like a soft prick slipping out of an overheated cunt, I, the still unhatched, making a few abortive wriggles, but either not dead and soft enough, or else sperm-free and skating ad astra, for it is still not dinner, and a peristaltic frenzy takes possession of the upper colon, the hypogastric region, the umbilical and the postpineal lobe. Boiled alive, the lobsters swim in ice, giving no quarter and asking no quarter, simply motionless and unmotivated in the ice-watered ennui of death, life drifting by the show window, muffled in desolation, a sorrowful scurvy eaten away by ptomaine, the frozen glass of the window cutting like a jackknife, clean and no remainder. Life drifting by the show window. I, too, as much a part of life as the lobster, the 14-carat ring, the horse liniment, but very difficult to establish the fact being that life is merchandise with a bill of lading attached, what I choose to eat being more important than I the eater, each one eating the other, and consequently eating, the verb, ruler of the roost. In the act of eating, the host is violated, and justice defeated temporarily. The plate, and what's on it, through the predatory power of the intestinal apparatus, commands attention, and unifies the spirit, first hypnotizing it, then slowly swallowing it, then masticating it, then absorbing it. The spiritual part of the being passes off like a scum, leaves absolutely no evidence or trace of its passage, vanishes, vanishes even more completely than a point in space after a mathematical discourse. The fever, which may return tomorrow, bears the same relation to life as the mercury in a thermometer bears to heat. Fever will not make life heat, which is what was to have been proved, and thus consecrates the meatballs and spaghetti. To chew while thousands chew, each chew an act of murder, gives the necessary social cast from which you look out the window and see that even humankind can be slaughtered justly, or maimed, or starved, or tortured, because while chewing, the mere advantage of sitting in a chair with clothes on, wiping the mouth with a napkin, enables you to comprehend what the wisest men have never been able to comprehend, namely, that there is no other way of life possible. Said wise men often disdaining to use chair, clothes, or napkin. Thus, men scurrying through a cunty cleft of a street called Broadway every day at regular hours in search of this or that, tend to establish this and that, which is exactly the method of mathematicians, logicians, physicists, astronomers, and such like. The proof is the fact, and the fact has no meaning except what is given to it by those who establish the facts. The meatballs devoured, the paper napkin carefully thrown on the floor, belching a trifle and not knowing why or whither, I step out into the 24-carat sparkle and fall in with the theater pack. This time I wander through the side streets following a blind man with an accordion. Now and then I sit on a stoop and listen to an aria. At the opera, the music makes no sense. Here in the street, it has just the right demented touch to give it poignancy. The woman who accompanies the blind man holds a tin cup in her hands. He is a part of life, too, like the tin cup, like the music of Verdi, like the Metropolitan Opera House. Everybody and everything is a part of life, but when they have all been added together, still somehow, it is not life. When is it life, I ask myself, and why not now? The blind man wanders on, and I remain sitting on the stoop. The meatballs were rotten, the coffee was lousy, the butter was rancid. Everything I look at is rotten, lousy, rancid. The street is like a bad breath, the next street is the same, and the next, and the next. At the corner, the blind man stops again and plays Home to Our Mountains. I find a piece of chewing gum in my pocket. I chew it. I chew for the sake of chewing. There is absolutely nothing better to do unless it were to make a decision, which is impossible. The stoop is comfortable, and nobody is bothering me. I am part of the world, of life, as they say, and I belong, and I don't belong. I sit on the stoop for an hour or so, mooning. I come to the same conclusions I always come to when I have a minute to think for myself. Either I must go home immediately and start to write, or I must run away and start a wholly new life. The thought of beginning a book terrifies me. There is so much to tell that I don't know where or how to begin. The thought of running away and beginning all over again is equally terrifying. It means working like a nigger to keep body and soul together. For a man of my temperament, the world being what it is, there is absolutely no hope, no solution. Even if I could write the book I want to write, nobody would take it. I know my compatriots only too well. Even if I could begin again, it would be no use, because fundamentally I have no desire to work, and no desire to become a useful member of society. I sit there staring at the house across the way. It seems not only ugly and senseless, like all the other houses on the street, but from staring at it so intently, it has suddenly become absurd. The idea of constructing a place of shelter in that particular way strikes me as absolutely insane. The city itself strikes me as a piece of the highest insanity. Everything about it, sewers, elevated lines, slot machines, newspapers, telephones, cops, doorknobs, flophouses, screens, toilet paper, everything. Everything could just as well not be, and not only nothing lost, but a whole universe gained. I look at the people brushing by me to see if by chance one of them might agree with me. Supposing I intercepted one of them and just asked him a simple question. Supposing I just said to him suddenly, "Why do you go on living the way you do?" He would probably call a cop. I ask myself, does anyone ever talk to himself the way I do? I ask myself if there isn't something wrong with me. The only conclusion I can come to is that I am different. And that's a very grave matter, view it how you will. Henry, I say to myself, rising slowly from the stoop, stretching myself, brushing my trousers, and spitting out the gum. Henry, I say to myself, you are young yet. You are just a spring chicken, and if you let them get you by the balls, you're an idiot, because you're a better man than any of them, only you need to get rid of your false notions about humanity. You have to realize, Henry, me boy, that you're dealing with cutthroats, with cannibals, only they're dressed up, shaved, perfumed, but that's all they are. Cutthroats. Cannibals. The best thing for you to do now, Henry, is to go and get yourself a frosted chocolate, and when you sit at the soda fountain, keep your eyes peeled and forget about the destiny of man, because you might still find yourself a nice lay, and a good lay will clean your ball bearings out and leave a good taste in your mouth, whereas this only brings on dyspepsia, dandruff, halitosis, encephalitis. And while I'm soothing myself thus, a guy comes up to me to bum a dime, and I hand him a quarter for good measure, thinking to myself that if I had had a little more sense, I'd have had a juicy pork chop with that instead of the lousy meatballs. But what's the difference now? It's all food, and food makes energy, and energy is what makes the world go round. Instead of the frosted chocolate, I keep walking, and soon I'm exactly where I intended to be all the time, which is in front of the ticket window of the Roseland. And now, Henry, says I to myself, if you're lucky, your old pal McGregor will be here, and first he'll bawl the shit out of you for running away, and then he'll lend you a five spot, and if you just hold your breath while climbing the stairs, maybe you'll see the nymphomaniac, too, and you'll get a dry fuck. Enter very calmly, Henry, and keep your eyes peeled. And I enter, as per instructions, on velvet toes, checking my hat and urinating a little as a matter of course, then slowly redescending the stairs and sizing up the taxi girls, all diaphanously gowned, powdered, perfumed, looking fresh and alert, but probably bored as hell and leg-weary. Into each and every one of them, as I shuffle about, I throw an imaginary fuck. The place is just plastered with cunt and fuck, and that's why I'm reasonably sure to find my old friend McGregor here. The way I no longer think about the condition of the world is marvelous. I mention it because for a moment, just while I was studying a juicy ass, I had a relapse. I almost went into a trance again. I was thinking, Christ help me, that maybe I ought to beat it and go home and begin the book. A terrifying thought. Once I spent a whole evening sitting in a chair and saw nothing and heard nothing. I must have written a good-sized book before I woke up. Better not to sit down. Better to keep circulating. Henry, what you ought to do is to come here sometime with a lot of dough and just see how far it'll take you. I mean 100 or 200 bucks and spend it like water and say yes to everything. The haughty-looking one with the statuesque figure. I bet she'd squirm like an eel if her palm were well greased. Supposing she said, 20 bucks, and you could say, sure. Supposing you could say, listen, I've got a car downstairs. Let's run down to Atlantic City for a few days. Henry, there ain't no car, and there ain't no 20 bucks. Don't sit down. Keep moving. At the rail which fences off the floor, I stand and watch them sailing around. This is no harmless recreation. This is serious business. At each end of the floor there is a sign reading, No Improper Dancing Allowed. Well and good. No harm in placing a sign at each end of the floor. In Pompeii they probably hung a phallus up. This is the American way. It means the same thing. I mustn't think about Pompeii, or I'll be sitting down and writing a book again. Keep moving, Henry. Keep your mind on the music. I keep struggling to imagine what a lovely time I would have if I had the price of a string of tickets. But the more I struggle, the more I slip back. Finally, I'm standing knee-deep in the lava beds, and the gas is choking me. It wasn't the lava that killed the Pompeians. It was the poison gas that precipitated the eruption. That's how the lava caught them in such queer poses, with their pants down, as it were. If suddenly all New York were caught that way, what a museum it would make! My friend McGregor standing at the sink, scrubbing his cock. The abortionists on the east side caught red-handed, the nuns lying in bed and masturbating one another, the auctioneer with an alarm clock in his hand, the telephone girls at the switchboard, J.P. Morganana sitting on the toilet bowl, placidly wiping his ass, Dix with rubber hoses giving the third degree, strippers giving the last strip and tease. Standing knee-deep in the lava beds and my eyes choked with sperm, J.P. Morganana is placidly wiping his ass while the telephone girls plug the switchboards, while Dix with rubber hoses practice the third degree, while my old friend McGregor scrubs the germs out of his cock and sweetens it and examines it under the microscope. Everybody caught with his pants down, including the strip teasers who wear no pants, no beards, no mustaches, just a little patch to cover their twinkling little cunts. Sister Antolina lying in the convent bed, her guts trussed up, her arms akimbo and waiting for the resurrection, waiting, waiting for life without hernia, without intercourse, without sin, without evil, meanwhile nibbling a few animal crackers, a pimento, some fancy olives, a little head cheese. The Jew boys on the east side, in Harlem, the Bronx, Canarsie, Brownsville, opening and closing the trap doors, pulling out arms and legs, turning the sausage machine, clogging up the drains, working like fury for cash down, and if you let a peep out of you, out you go. With 1,100 tickets in my pocket and a Rolls Royce waiting for me downstairs, I could have the most excruciatingly marvelous time, throwing a fuck into each and every one, respectively, regardless of age, sex, race, religion, nationality, birth, or breeding. There is no solution for a man like myself, I being what I am, and the world being what it is. The world is divided into three parts, of which two parts are meatballs and spaghetti, and the other part a huge syphilitic canker. The haughty one with the statuesque figure is probably a cold turkey fuck, a sort of con anonyme plastered with gold leaf and tin foil. Beyond despair and disillusionment, there is always the absence of worse things and the emoluments of ennui. Nothing is lousier and emptier than the midst of bright gaiety clicked by the mechanical eye of the mechanical epoch, life maturing in a black box, a negative tickled with acid and yielding a momentaneous simulacrum of nothingness. At the outermost limit of this momentaneous nothingness, my friend McGregor arrives and is standing by my side, and with him is the one he was talking about, the nymphomaniac called Paula. She has the loose, jaunty swing and perch of the double-barreled sex. All her movements, radiating from the groin, always in equilibrium, always ready to flow, to wind and twist and clutch, the eyes going tiptoe, the toes twitching and twinkling, the flesh rippling like a lake furrowed by a breeze. This is the incarnation of the hallucination of sex, the sea nymph squirming in the maniac's arms. I watch the two of them as they move spasmodically inch by inch around the floor. They move like an octopus working up a rut. Between the dangling tentacles, the music shimmers and flashes, now breaks into a cascade of sperm and rose water, forms again into an oily spout, a column standing erect without feet, collapses again like chalk, leaving the upper part of the leg phosphorescent, a zebra standing in a pool of golden marshmallow, one leg striped, the other molten. A golden marshmallow octopus with rubber hinges and molten hoofs, its sex undone and twisted into a knot. On the seafloor, the oysters are doing the St. Vitus dance, some with lockjaw, some with double-jointed knees. The music is sprinkled with rat poison, with the rattlesnake's venom, with the fetid breath of the gardenia, the spittle of the sacred yak, the bollocksed sweat of the muskrat, the leper's sugar-coated nostalgia. The music is a diarrhea, a lake of gasoline, stagnant with cockroaches and stale horse piss. The drooling notes are the foam and dribble of the epileptic, the night sweat of the fornicating nigger frigged by the Jew. All America is in the trombone's smear. That frazzled, broken-down whinny of the gangrened sea cows stationed off Point Loma, Pawtucket, Cape Hatteras, Labrador, Canarsie, and intermediate points. The octopus is dancing like a rubber dick, the rumba of Spiton Dival inedi. Laura the nympho is doing the rumba, her sex exfoliated and twisted like a cow's tail. In the belly of the trombone lies the American soul farting its contented heart out. Nothing goes to waste, not the least spit of a fart. In the golden marshmallow dream of happiness, in the dance of the sodden piss and gasoline, the great soul of the American continent gallops like an octopus, all the sails unfurled, the hatches down, the engine whirring like a dynamo. The great dynamic soul caught in the click of the camera's eye, in the heat of rut, bloodless as a fish, slippery as mucus, the soul of the people miscegenating on the seafloor, pop-eyed with longing, harrowed with lust. The dance of Saturday night, of cantaloupes rotting in the garbage pail, of fresh green snot and slimy unguents for the tender parts, the dance of the slot machine and the monsters who invent them, the dance of the gat and the slugs who use them, the dance of the blackjack and the pricks who batter brains to a polypus pulp, the dance of the magneto world, the spark that unsparks, the soft purr of the perfect mechanism, the velocity race on a turntable, the dollar at par, and the forests dead and mutilated. The Saturday night of the soul's hollow dance, each jumping jigger a functional unit in the St. Vitus dance of the ringworm's dream. Laura the nympho brandishing her cunt, her sweet rose-petal lips toothed with ball-bearing clutches, her ass bald and socketed. Inch by inch, millimeter by millimeter, they shove the copulating corpse around, and then crash. Like pulling a switch, the music suddenly stops, and with the stoppage the dancers come apart, arms and legs intact, like tea leaves dropping to the bottom of the cup. Now the air is blue with words, a slow sizzle as of fish on the griddle. The chaff of the empty soul rising like monkey chatter in the topmost branches of the trees. The air blue with words passing out through the ventilators, coming back again in sleep through corrugated funnels and smokestacks, winged like the antelope, striped like the zebra, now lying quiet as the mollusk, now spitting flame. Laura the nympho, cold as a statue, her parts eaten away, her hair musically enraptured. On the brink of sleep, Laura stands with muted lips, her words falling like pollen through a fog. The Laura of Petrarch, seated in a taxi, each word ringing through the cash register, then sterilized, then cauterized. Laura the basilisk, made entirely of asbestos, walking to the fiery stake with a mouthful of gum. Hunky-dory is the word on her lips. The heavy fluted lips of the seashell, Laura's lips, the lips of lost Uranian love. All floating shadow-word through the slanting fog. Last murmuring dregs of shell-like lips slipping off the Labrador coast, oozing eastward with the mud tides, easing starward in the iodine drift. Lost Laura, last of the Petrarchs, slowly fading on the brink of sleep. Not gray the world, but lackluster, the light bamboo sleep of spoon-backed innocence. And this, in the black frenzied nothingness of the hollow of absence, leaves a gloomy feeling of saturated despondency, not unlike the topmost tip of desperation, which is only the gay, juvenile maggot of death's exquisite rupture with life. From this inverted cone of ecstasy, life will rise again into prosaic skyscraper eminence, dragging me by the hair and teeth. Lousy with howling, empty joy, the animated fetus of the unborn death maggot lying in wait for rot and putrefaction. Sunday morning, the telephone wakes me up. It's my friend Maxie Schneidig announcing the death of our friend Luke Ralston. Maxie has assumed a truly sorrowful tone of voice, which rubs me the wrong way. He says Luke was such a swell guy. That, too, sounds the wrong note for me, because while Luke was all right, he was only so-so, not precisely what you might call a swell guy. Luke was an ingrown fairy, and finally, when I got to know him intimately, a big pain in the ass. I told Maxie that over the telephone. I could tell from the way he answered me that he didn't like it very much. He said Luke had always been a friend to me. It was true enough, but it wasn't enough. The truth was that I was really glad Luke had kicked off at the opportune moment. It meant that I could forget about the $150 which I owed him. In fact, as I hung up the receiver, I really felt joyous. It was a tremendous relief not to have to pay that debt. As for Luke's demise, that didn't disturb me in the least. On the contrary, it would enable me to pay a visit to his sister, Lottie, whom I always wanted to lay but never could for one reason or another. Now I could see myself going up there in the middle of the day and offering her my condolences. Her husband would be at the office, and there would be nothing to interfere. I saw myself putting my arms around her and comforting her. Nothing like tackling a woman when she is in sorrow. I could see her opening her eyes wide. She had beautiful large gray eyes as I moved her toward the couch. She was the sort of woman who would give you a fuck while pretending to be talking music or some such thing. She didn't like the naked reality, the bare facts, so to speak. At the same time, she'd have enough presence of mind to slip a towel under her, so as not to stain the couch. I knew her inside out. I knew that the best time to get her was now. Now, while she was running up a little fever of emotion over dear dead Luke, whom she didn't think much of, by the way. Unfortunately, it was Sunday, and the husband would be sure to be home. I went back to bed, and I lay there thinking first about Luke and all that he had done for me, and then about her, Lottie. Lottie Summers was her name. It always seemed a beautiful name to me. It matched her perfectly. Luke was stiff as a poker, with a sort of skull and bones face and impeccable and just beyond words. She was just the opposite. Soft, round, spoke with a drawl, caressed her words, moved languidly, used her eyes effectively. One would never take them for brother and sister. I got so worked up thinking about her that I tried to tackle the wife. But that poor bastard with her puritanical complex pretended to be horrified. She liked Luke. She wouldn't say that he was a swell guy, because that wasn't like her, but she insisted that he was genuine, loyal, a true friend, etc. I had so many loyal, genuine, true friends that that was all horseshit to me. Finally, we got into such an argument over Luke that she got an hysterical attack and began to weep and sob, in bed, mind you. That made me hungry. The idea of weeping before breakfast seemed monstrous to me. I went downstairs and I fixed myself a wonderful breakfast, and as I put it away I was laughing to myself about Luke, about the $150 that his sudden death had wiped off the slate, about Lottie and the way she would look at me when the moment came, and finally, the most absurd of all, I thought of Maxie Schnadig, the faithful friend of Luke, standing at the grave with a big wreath and perhaps throwing a handful of earth on the coffin just as they were lowering it. Somehow that seemed just too stupid for words. I don't know why it should seem so ridiculous, but it did. Maxie was a simpleton. I tolerated him only because he was good for a touch now and then. And then, too, there was his sister, Rita. I used to let him invite me to his home occasionally, pretending that I was interested in his brother, who was deranged. It was always a good meal, and the half-witted brother was real entertainment. He looked like a chimpanzee, and he talked like one, too. Maxie was too simple to suspect that I was merely enjoying myself. He thought I took a genuine interest in his brother. It was a beautiful Sunday, and I had, as usual, about a quarter in my pocket. I walked along, wondering where to go to make a touch. Not that it was difficult to scrape up a little dough, no, but the thing was to get the dough and beat it without being bored stiff. I could think of a dozen guys right in the neighborhood, guys who would fork it out without a murmur, but it would mean a long conversation afterwards about art, religion, politics. Another thing I could do, which I had done over and over again in a pinch, was to visit the telegraph offices, pretending to pay a friendly visit of inspection, and then at the last minute suggest that they rifle the till for a buck or so until the morrow. That would involve time, and even worse, conversation. Thinking it over coldly and calculatingly, I decided that the best bet was my little friend Curly, up in Harlem. If Curly didn't have the money, he would filch it from his mother's purse. I knew I could rely on him. He would want to accompany me, of course, but I could always find a way of ditching him before the evening was over. He was only a kid, and I didn't have to be too delicate with him. What I liked about Curly was that, although only a kid of 17, he had absolutely no moral sense, no scruples, no shame. He had come to me as a boy of 14, looking for a job as messenger. His parents, who were then in South America, had shipped him to New York in care of an aunt who seduced him almost immediately. He had never been to school because the parents were always traveling. They were carnival people who worked the grifts and the grinds, as he put it. The father had been in prison several times. He was not his real father, by the way. Anyway, Curly came to me as a mere lad who was in need of help, in need of a friend more than anything. At first I thought I could do something for him. Everybody took a liking to him, immediately, especially the women. He became the pet of the office. Before long, however, I realized that he was incorrigible, that at the best he had the makings of a clever criminal. I liked him, however, and I continued to do things for him, but I never trusted him out of my sight. I think I liked him particularly because he had absolutely no sense of honor. He would do anything in the world for me, and at the same time, betray me. I couldn't reproach him for it. It was amusing to me, the more so because he was frank about it. He just couldn't help it. His Aunt Sophie, for instance. He said she had seduced him. True enough, but the curious thing was that he let himself be seduced while they were reading the Bible together. Young as he was, he seemed to realize that his Aunt Sophie had need of him in that way. So he let himself be seduced, as he said, and then, after I'd known him a little while, he offered to put me next to his Aunt Sophie. He even went so far as to blackmail her. When he needed money badly, he would go to the aunt and wheedle it out of her, with sly threats of exposure. With an innocent face, to be sure. He looked amazingly like an angel, with big, liquid eyes that seemed so frank and sincere, so ready to do things for you, almost like a faithful dog. And then cunning enough, once he had gained your favor, to make you humor his little whims. Withal, extremely intelligent. The sly intelligence of a fox, and the utter heartlessness of a jackal.